Disc 8.
If he does not emerge as an attractive figure from his biographies, or from Flashman's brief sketch on short acquaintance, it is still hard not to feel sympathy for Franz Joseph. His own faults may have contributed to his ill luck in love and war and statecraft, but it would have taken a ruler of unusual intelligence and political skill to bridge successfully the long imperial sunset from the end of Europe's ancien régime to the age of jazz and democracy and mechanized warfare, and these he simply did not have. He had tried to rule as an absolute monarch, presiding over a centralized bureaucracy and suppressing nationalist ambitions, especially those of Hungary, among the ill-assorted races of his unwieldy empire. Changing times had forced him into reluctant concessions, but his reactionary nature and passion for the detail of administration, over which he laboured conscientiously, had blinded him to those greater issues which he had neither the vision nor the temperament to understand. Such virtues as he had were physical rather than intellectual, which befitted the romantic prince of his early days. Tall, handsome, recklessly brave, if unsuccessful as a soldier, a splendid horseman and ardent sportsman. He seems to have been amiable and kindly at his best, although one biographer writes of his haughty and offensive arrogance, and quotes examples. His personal tastes were Spartan, his manner dignified and formal, and he was punctilious in matters of protocol, a characteristic which was no help in his marriage. Franz Joseph's chief recreation was in rural pursuits, shooting above all, and he was never happier than roving the woods above Ischl with his gun, leading the simple life. His other love was the theatre and its ladies, and the close companion of his old age was an actress, Frau Schratt, to whom he was so closely attached that he became known as Herr Schratt. His marriage to Elizabeth of Bavaria, the glamorous Sissy, or Sisi, began as a fairy tale and ended in unhappiness and tragedy. We have Flashman's authoritative word for it that she was a rare beauty, although some of her portraits suggest that she was strikingly pretty, rather than classically perfect. Franz Joseph fell in love with her at first sight, but he was not a faithful husband, and while his teenage bride never paid him back in kind, she was too lively and spirited to be a docile little empress. Quite apart from Franz Joseph's infidelities, which did in fact lead to her infection, there were causes enough of disagreement. Sissy detested the ultra-formal etiquette of a hostile court, was disliked by her mother-in-law, developed strong Hungarian sympathies, and had a decidedly eccentric streak in her nature, all of which combined to bring about the imperial couple's estrangement. The adoration in which she was held, especially in Hungary, probably did not help. She took to wandering about Europe, cruising the Mediterranean and hunting in England and Ireland, a royal gypsy, admired not only for her looks and charm, but for her generous interest in charitable causes, and for that wayward independence which had so shocked Vienna. She was a fearless horsewoman, an expert gymnast who worked out regularly in a portable gym, a health and beauty fanatic who wrote poetry, suffered periodic bouts of ill health and depression, and all too often gave signs of that instability which led Flashman to doubt her sanity. Elizabeth bore Franz Joseph 3 daughters and a son, Rudolf, who is remembered only as the chief actor in the tragedy of Meierling, where he took his own life and that of his mistress in 1889. 9 years later, Elizabeth was stabbed to death by an anti-royalist fanatic at Geneva. She was 60 years old. See Henri de Vindale, The Real Francis Joseph, 1909. Francis Gribble, Life of the Emperor Francis Joseph, 1914. Gordon Brooke Shepherd, Royal Sunset, 1987. A. de Burgh, Elizabeth, Empress of Austria, 1899. Andrew Sinclair, Death by Fame, 1998. There follow various notes on this Flashman story. Henri Stéphan Oppert Blowitz, 1825 to 1903, was Paris correspondent of the Times from 1875 to 1902. A Bohemian Jew, born of a good family in what became Czechoslovakia, he worked as a teacher in France before becoming a journalist, almost by accident, and showed that he possessed to a remarkable degree that combination of talents that makes a first-class reporter, immense energy and curiosity, a nose for news, and that mysterious gift of inspiring confidence which makes people talk. He had contacts at the highest level all over Europe, a prodigious memory, a brass neck, and great ingenuity. Some said lack of scruple, which together raised him to a unique position in his profession. Flashman has drawn him faithfully, and plainly had some affection and considerable respect for the tiny, rotund, charming, bombastic, and rather comic eccentric, whose love of good living, susceptibility to female beauty, delight in extravagant dress, and generous good nature endeared him to many. Naturally, he inspired considerable jealousy in his rivals, and was not without detractors to question both his methods and his ability. That Blowitz, the brilliant and hard-headed reporter and interviewer, was at the same time an incurable romantic, with a taste for melodrama and love of the sensational, is obvious from his memoirs, a highly entertaining work made up of material published in his lifetime, and episodes dictated in his last year. He kept no diaries, and is said to have taken a note only rarely. How far the memoirs are to be trusted is a nice point. Flashman was familiar with them, but is no guide to their reliability. Part of his story is identical in outline with one chapter of the memoirs, but since Blowitz is the source in both cases, this means nothing. The enthusiastic Bohemian was never one to spoil a good tale for want of dramatic colouring. And Frank Giles, a later Times Paris correspondent, whose biography of Blowitz is admirably fair and meticulously researched, describes the memoirs as a remarkable collection of fact and fiction, and echoes the feeling of a former Times proprietor that, at times, the facts have collapsed under the sheer weight of a powerful imagination. Much of what Blowitz wrote can never be checked, and there is no knowing how great a part his vivid imagination played in what he told Flashman, who seems to have believed him for what that is worth. I do not hesitate to cite Blowitz in these footnotes, for whatever his failings, he was at his best the most superior kind of journalist, a real reporter. Blowitz's obsession with destiny, etc., his tales of adventure with Marseille communards, mysterious European royalty, and his kidnapping by gypsies, are to be found in the memoirs. The story that he and his lover threw the lady's husband overboard in Marseille harbour is told by Prince von Bulow, later German Chancellor, who is not regarded as an invariably reliable source. See Blowitz's My Memoirs, 1903, Frank Giles, A Prince of Journalists, 1962. Prince von Bulow, Memoirs, 1849 to 1897, 1932. Which contains a fine picture of Blowitz in his working clothes. When and where Flashman served in the French Foreign Legion has not yet emerged from his papers. Several references, like the present one, suggest North Africa, but it is not impossible that he was with the Legion in Mexico, circa 1867, when he was aide-de-camp to the ill-fated Emperor Maximilian. Au jus was the cry of the coffee orderlies at Revale, and the sausage music is presumably a reference to the Legion's march, Tiens, voilà du boudin. The authority for Grant's meeting with McMahon and their total failure to communicate is Grant himself. At least they bowed and shook hands. Grant's aversion to handshaking was notorious, as was his taciturnity. In 1878, Sir Stafford Northcote's budget, described as unambitious, increased the duty on dogs and tobacco, and raised income tax by tuppence. Mrs. Brassey published The Voyage of the Sunbeam, an account of her round-the-world cruise by yacht. The phonograph, an instrument which prints sound for subsequent reproduction by electricity, was a popular novelty. And Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore had its first night on May the 25th at the Opera Comique. The great hit of the show was He is an Englishman, which became almost a second national anthem. As usual, with his summaries of international affairs, Flashman's account of events in the Balkans, the Russo-Turkish War, and the Treaty of San Stefano, is sketchy and racy, but accurate in its broad essentials. The treaty, reflecting Russia's pan-Slavic ambition to bring the Balkans under Russian control, was hard on the defeated Turks, and was opposed by Austria and Britain. A conference of the European powers had been in prospect for some time, but was jeopardized by Russia's objection to a British demand that the San Stefano settlement should be submitted to discussion by the powers. Largely through the honest broker efforts of Bismarck, the German Chancellor, an understanding was reached between Britain and Russia, and the Congress of Berlin was held in June and July of 1878, to revise the treaty and achieve a balance in southeastern Europe. Blowitz's opinion of Shuvalov is echoed in von Bulow. Count Shuvalov was a clever, skillful, amiable, and distinguished man, but like so many Russians, he worshipped more than was fitting at the shrine of Aphrodite Pandemos. The cartoons of the two English grooms and the crafty fishmonger, and the article headed Hanky Panky, are to be found in Punch of May the 11th, 1878. The voluptuous figure entitled Harlequin Spring Fashions, really a very little addition to the too scanty and bespangled costumes Mr. Punch has noticed so often lately, appeared in the previous week. According to von Bulow, on one of his evening walks in the Friedrichstrasse, which the Berlin police supervised so discreetly, to prevent any unpleasant incident, he, Shuvalov, had made the acquaintance of a too facile lady, from whose arms it was difficult to entice him. Flashman's version of the Congress of Berlin tallies fairly well with Blowitz's, which does not differ in its essentials from other accounts. From whom Blowitz obtained the advance copy of the treaty is unknown. Waddington, the French foreign minister, has been suggested. He was English by blood, though born in Paris, and like Flashman was educated at Rugby, but there is no evidence that he was the source of the leak. What is certain is that Blowitz had an excellent source at the heart of the Congress, and scooped his rivals in day-to-day reporting, as well as in obtaining the treaty, much to their annoyance, especially the Germans. He did interview Bismarck, whose under-the-table complaint is authentic, and seems to have bluffed him into withholding the treaty from the German press, by himself demanding an exclusive copy. He left the Congress early, pretending to sulk, dictated from memory a substantial portion to his secretary, had the text telegraphed from Brussels by his secretary, and the following day had the satisfaction of an exclusive story in the Times. It was one of the greatest scoops in newspaper history, although Flashman is wrong in saying that all the clauses appeared. In fact, seven did not. There is one important difference between Flashman's version of the Congress and that given by Blowitz in his memoirs. Blowitz says that his information source and go-between was a young foreigner who had approached Blowitz for help, and whom he infiltrated into the entourage of an unidentified statesman at the Congress. Once installed, he passed information to Blowitz by means of the hat exchange. This seems a highly unlikely story, and it is reasonable to assume that Blowitz, in writing his memoirs, invented it to protect the identities of Flashman, Caprice, and Shuvalov. It is worth noting that von Bulow's story of Shuvalov's infatuation with a courtesan is consistent with Flashman's version. Sir Garnet, later Viscount Wolseley, confirmed his reputation as Britain's first soldier by his suppression in 1882 of the Egyptian army's revolt against the Khedive. The rebellion was led by Arabi Pasha, an ardent nationalist and anti-European, and after the massacre of more than 100 foreigners at Alexandria, The port's defences were bombarded by the Royal Navy, and Egypt was invaded by Wolseley's force, which eventually numbered 40,000. He gained control of the Suez Canal, and when his advance guard was attacked by Arabi at Kassassin on August the 28th, the Egyptian infantry were routed by a moonlight charge of the British cavalry, in which the Life Guards and the Blues of the Household Brigade, tin bellies to flashmen, were prominent. Sir Baker Russell's horse was shot under him, but he mounted another, presumably with flashmen's insistence. Arabi's army of about 40,000 was strongly entrenched at Tel El Kebir. But after a remarkable night march of 6 miles in silence, Wolseley's force made a surprise dawn attack, headed by the Highland Brigade, who overwhelmed the Egyptian position. About 2,000 of the defenders were killed, for the loss of 58 British dead and 400 wounded and missing. Cairo was occupied after a forced march, Arabi was captured and exiled to Ceylon, and the rebellion had been crushed in 25 days. One can only take Flashman's word for it that there was a strong shave rumour in the clubs about Gordon as early as the beginning of October. The situation in the Sudan did not begin to look critical until after the wipeout of Hicks's command by the Mahdi at Kashgil early in November, and Gordon's name does not appear to have been mentioned in official circles until some weeks later, when Gordon himself was still contemplating service in the Congo. No doubt Flashman's instinct for self-preservation made him unusually prescient. The first official journey of the famous Orient Express began at the Gare de l'Est, Paris, on the evening of Sunday, October the 4th, 1883. The great train was the brainchild of Georges Nagelmackers of Liège, founder of the Compagnie Internationale des Wagons-Lits, and realized his dream of a through express of unsurpassed luxury, which should run to the ends of Europe. That first train consisted of the locomotive, two baggage cars, two sleeping cars, and a dining salon which was to become justly famous. About 40 passengers, all male as far as Vienna, where two ladies came aboard, made the inaugural trip from Paris to Constantinople, among them ministers of the French and Belgian governments, several journalists, including Blowitz, a Turkish diplomat, Mishak Effendi, identified by a Flashman, and Nagelmackers himself. It is interesting, in view of the alias supplied by Blowitz for Flashman in Berlin 5 years earlier, that on the Orient Express Blowitz shared voiture 151 with a Dutchman named Janssen. Blowitz got a book out of the trip, which was a memorable one even by his standards. For in Constantinople he obtained the first interview ever granted by the ruler of the Ottoman Empire, Sultan Abdulhamid II. In Bucharest he also interviewed the King of Romania, and being Blowitz, he thoroughly enjoyed the luxury and conviviality of the journey, especially the dining salon. One cannot blame him, as all who have travelled on it agree, there is no train like the Orient Express. Whoever Princess Kralta may have been, she was obviously a lady of considerable attraction and character. It is possible that Blowitz concealed her real name, since it is a device he employs elsewhere in his memoirs. The only hint he gives of her origin is to describe her mother as an Oriental flower. But from Flashman's description, it would seem that her father at least was European, and Northern European at that. Be that as it may, Krauter appears to have occupied an influential position in continental diplomatic and royal society. The account of her activities which Blowitz gave to Flashman tallies closely with the memoirs. Her acquaintance with Bismarck, his employment of her to discover how Blowitz had got the Berlin Treaty, the melodramatic incident of the candle in the draft, which alerted Blowitz to her treachery, and the sensational tale of how, at the German Emperor's request, she soothed the distracted Bismarck with some kind of diversion. All these are in the chapter entitled, with Blowitzian panache, The Revenge of Venus. He does not state bluntly how she diverted Bismarck, but the inference could hardly be clearer. For Flashman's experiences with Crowther, we have only his own testimony. As to her appearance and personality, he is more detailed than Blowitz, but there are no contradictions between them. Both agree that she was imperious and charming, and while Flashman is more specific about what are called vital statistics, he can have had no quarrel with the little bohemian's romantic raptures. Blowitz was beglamoured on first sight of the princess at a dinner party, to such an extent that he could not remember who else was present, a most unusual lapse of his remarkable memory. He enthuses about her beauty, radiance, exquisite elegance, silky hair, chestnut at their first meeting, but subsequently golden, melodious voice, blue eyes which lighted up one of the most fascinating faces I have ever seen, and so on. He even notes the brilliancy of her teeth. There is something approaching awe in his description of her crossing a room with the vague rustle of her silken robes, like a rapid vision. And one gets the impression sometimes that he was rather afraid of her. This is the first substantial reference in the papers to Flashman's sojourn in Mexico in the latter half of the 1860s. Hitherto we have known only that he spent time in a Mexican prison, and was an aide-de-camp to the unfortunate Emperor Maximilian, younger brother of Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria. Maximilian, an amiable and well-intentioned prince, interested in botany, was a pawn in the ambitious schemes of Napoleon III of France, who took advantage of civil war in Mexico to send in a French army, ostensibly to collect war debts from the victorious liberals of Benito Juarez, but in fact to establish a puppet empire under Maximilian, who was persuaded to accept the Mexican crown in 1863. He set up a government and was planning social and educational reforms, including freedom for the Indians. But Juarez's forces remained hostile to the imperial regime, and when Napoleon withdrew his forces, partly owing to pressure from the Americans, who were sympathetic to Juarez's Republicans, Maximilian was left to his fate. He made a brave fight of it, but was captured by the Juaristas in May 1867 and executed by firing squad in the following month. What part Flashman played in these events will no doubt be revealed when his Mexican papers come to light. We know that he was in the U.S. with President Lincoln a few days before the latter's death in April 1865, so his Mexican adventures were presumably confined to the next 2 years, at most. The reference to Princess Salma Salm, the wife of Prince Felix Salm Salm, a German officer who served in the U.S. Civil War, possibly with Flashman, and was later chief ADC to Maximilian in Mexico, suggests that Flashman was involved in the efforts which both the prince and princess made to save the emperor's life. She was a handsome and fearless lady, who has left a spirited account of her adventures in Mexico, and of her later life in European royal circles, and in the Franco-Prussian War, in which her husband was killed. Her 10 Years of My Life, 1868, and The Prince's My Diary in Mexico, 1874, which she published after his death, gave invaluable details of Maximilian's last days. That the Emperor Maximilian was a cricketer seems to be confirmed by a photograph in a Brussels museum, in which he is seen posing at the end of a match with members of the British legation in Mexico City, circa 1865. The editor is indebted to Colonel J. M. C. Watson for a copy of this picture. Flashman seldom elaborates on international affairs, and it is probable that he has summarized, with commendable accuracy, the information given him by Willem von Starnberg, touching on the state of the Austrian Empire and its ruler, the Hungarian question, and the relations of Emperor Franz Joseph, the Empress Elizabeth, Sisi, and their son, the Crown Prince Rudolf. In 1853, Franz Joseph of Austria had escaped with a bad neck wound when he was stabbed by a Hungarian apprentice, whose knife was impeded by the Emperor's stiff military collar. Uniform also saved the life of the elderly German Emperor in 1878, when the helmet which he insisted on wearing, in accordance with regulations, took the blast of a double-barreled shotgun. He had survived another shooting attempt only 3 weeks earlier. Tsar Alexander II of Russia was less fortunate. He was killed by a second bomb in St. Petersburg in 1881, only minutes after an earlier device had wrecked his carriage. Ischl, in Flashman's time, had a population of fewer than 3,000 and seems to have changed little since then. Its lack of size makes it a pleasant little gem among European resorts, tranquil and unhurried in its grand surroundings and its shops and coffee houses, with their remarkable range of confections, remains as attractive as ever. It is appropriate that such a Ruritanian setting should have been home to Franz Leha after Flashman's day. His villa remains on the banks of the Traun. The Golden Ship was serving excellent cabbage a few years ago, and Frosch and his colleagues were still amusing audiences at the little theatre. Anyone visiting the Kaiser Villa, the royal lodge at Bad Ischl, will probably share Flashman's abiding memory. The lodge today, as much as he describes it, and the horns of the emperor's quarries still adorn its walls in profusion. There is, in fact, a secret stairway from the emperor's rooms, remarkably modest chambers, simply furnished with, among other items, the plain iron bedstead which he used. It is such an ordinary bedroom that it is hard to realize that this is where the First World War began. Flashman's brief acquaintance with Franz Joseph illustrates many of the emperor's characteristics: his passion for the military, his poor grasp of languages other than his own, his rather stuffy formality, his devotion to administrative detail, and the simplicity of his tastes. Boiled beef and beer was a favorite meal. He enjoyed his rubbers of tarok, and in his later years especially, it was a regular evening pastime. There is an old salt mine in the mountains of the Salzkammergut above Ischl, which corresponds so closely to Flashman's description that it must surely be the same one. The strange pool is still there, and the bogies run on rails from the mine entrance into the great cavern. The quoted line is spoken by Rudolf Rassendyll to Count Rupert of Hensau in The Prisoner of Zenda. Flashman claimed that he told the story of his Strykens adventure to Anthony Hope Hawkins, later Sir Anthony Hope, and that the novelist used it as the basis for his famous romance, modelling the Count of Hensau on Rudi von Starnberg. Caprice must have charmed at least 3 copies of Punch from her English tourist, including the most recent issue, October the 13th, in which France is depicted as a homely old woman. The cartoon of Gladstone dancing the hornpipe is from a September number. He was on a cruise with Lord Tennyson, and the alluring figure labelled Manchester Ship Canal is earlier still. Punch's anti-Gallic prejudice runs through all 3 numbers. The blimpish British officers cited by Flashman are characters in Hector Servadac, one of Jules Verne's later science fiction novels, 1877. Police whistles came into use in 1883. There were many distinguished de la Tour d'Auvergne, principally Théophile Malocoré of that name, a French soldier renowned for his courage and chivalry, who died in 1800, having consistently refused promotion beyond the rank of captain. He was known as the first grenadier of France. W. Pembroke Fettridge was the author of The American Traveller's Guide, Harper's Handbook for Travellers in Europe, which first appeared in 1862. Flashman probably had the 1871 edition. The unique position which Chinese Gordon held in the eyes of officialdom and the public was demonstrated by the fact that when he left Charing Cross Station for the Sudan, the Foreign Secretary bought his ticket, the Duke of Cambridge held the carriage door for him, and Lord, formerly Sir Garnet, Wolseley, carried his bag. And now, The Subtleties of Baccarat, 1890 and 1891. "See here, Flashman," says the Prince of Wales, looking hunted and chewing his cigar, as though a plug tobacco. You must get me out of this. God knows what Mother would say. I couldn't think there was much she hadn't said already. When you're a queen of unblemished virtue, devoted to duty and the high moral tone, and your son and heir to the throne is a notorious wastrel who counts all time lost when he ain't stuffing, swilling, sponging off rich toad-eaters, and rogering everything in skirts, you're apt to be censorious. Why, she'd once told Elspeth that she was determined to outlive the brute, because he wasn't fit to be king, so there. But in the present instance, so far as I'd gathered from his incoherent growls, I was shot if I could see what he was in a stew about. For once he appeared to be blameless. Yet here he was, mangling his weed and twitching like a frightened Falstaff. We were alone, and he was too fretful to be on his dignity. So I guided him to a chair, soothed him with a stiff P&S, lit him a fresh smoke, waited courtier-like while he coughed his innards out, and invited him to restate his troubles, as calmly as might be, to sympathetic old Flashy. "I've just told you," snaps he, wheezing and wiping his piggy eyes. "It is the most shocking business. They say Bill Cummin has cheated at baccarat." That's what I thought he'd said the first time, and wondered if I'd misheard. But he seemed sober and rational, if agitated. "You mean last night, sir, in the billiard-room?"
"Yes, confounded, in the night before. You were there, hang it all."
Well, I had been, as an occasional spectator, looking in from time to time, to make sure my feather-brained wife wasn't slapping down her jewellery and crying banco. But I wasn't having this. I should explain that baccarat is the most imbecile of card games. Elspeth plays it, after all. In which half-wits sit round a large table, and the banker deals two cards to the crowd on his right, two to those on his left, and two to himself, the object being to get as near a total of nine with your two cards as may be. If your side gets two deuces, you'll ask for a third card, won't you? Hoping for a four or a five, and the banker has the same privilege. If he gets closer to nine, he wins. If he doesn't, you win. Endless fun, my dear, assuming you can count up to nine, and if it don't rival chess exactly, at least its simplicity leaves little room for sharp practice, which is why I couldn't credit what his fat highness was telling me. "Cheated at baccarat? No, sir, can't be done," I told him. "Well, not unless you're the banker, and even then, with a four-pack deck, more than 200 cards, why, you'd have to be the very devil of a mechanic." I considered. "Can't think I've ever seen it tried. No, not out west, even. Mind you, they don't go in for baccarat much. Vingt et un, mostly, and poker."
"Damn poker!" croaks he. "He cheated, I tell you, and I was the blasted banker."
Come to think of it, so he had been on both nights, and for a happy moment I wondered if he'd been slipping them off the bottom himself, and was trying to shift the blame in true royal style. But that wouldn't do. He hadn't the spunk for it.
"Let me get this right, sir. You tell me Gordon Cummin cheated? For God's sake, who says so?" "Coventry and Owen Williams. There can be no doubt about it. I saw nothing wrong, but they're quite positive."
Since one of them was a deaf peer and t'other a Welsh major general, I didn't put much stock in this. "They say they saw him sharping."
No, not they. These dreadful Wilson people. The young ones. Our host's children, damn it. Four or five of them, young Wilson, and that impossible fellow Green, and two of the ladies even. They all saw him cheat, I tell you."
He thumped his knee, almost eating his cigar.
"Why did I ever allow myself to be prevailed upon to come to this infernal house? It will be a lesson to me, Flashman, I don't mind telling you. Did you ever hear anything so monstrous?"
"If it's true, sir, how do they say he cheated?"
"Why, by adding to his stake, putting on counters after the coups were declared in his side's favour, and taking them off when he'd lost. They saw him do it time and again, apparently, on both nights, when I," groans he, "was holding the bank."
The more I heard, the dafter it became. I'm no gambling man myself, much, and have never had the skill or nerve for sharping, anyway. But in my time I've seen them all, stud games in Abilene livery stables with guns and gold pokes down on the blanket, Knapp schools from Ballarat to the Bay, penny ante blackjack in political country houses, with Disraeli dealing and that oily little worm Bryant planting aces in my unsuspecting pockets, damn him. And watch the sharks at work with cold decks, shaved edges, marked backs, and everything up their sleeves bar a trained midget. And you may take my word for it, the last place on God's earth you'd want to sit on the Queen of Spades or try to juggle the stakes is Grandmama's drawing-room after dinner. You won't last 5 minutes. As Gordon Cumming, I was asked to believe, had discovered.
And no one said anything at the time? Why, no.
He blinked in bearded bewilderment. No, they did not. The ladies, I suppose. The ghastly scene must have followed. He made vague gestures with his cigar, but they felt they could not keep silent altogether and told Williams and Coventry, and they, he fairly snarled, have told me before dinner tonight why they felt obliged to drag me into the wretched business. I cannot think it's too bad.
Sheer vaporing, of course, as Prince of Wales, first gentleman of Europe, God help us. He was the bright particular star and pack leader of the genteel rabble assembled at Tramby Croft, Yorks, for the Doncaster races, and knew perfectly well that any serious breach of polite behaviour by a fellow guest, such as Card Sharpin, was bound to land on his mat. I reminded him of this tactfully, and added that I didn't believe it for a minute. Some foolish mistake or misunderstanding, I said, depend upon it. No such thing. He heaved his guts out of the chair and began to pace about. The young Wilsons and Green, I and that chap, what's his name, Levitt, who is in Cumming's own regiment, for heaven's sake, all avow it. They saw him cheat. Coventry and Williams are in no doubt whatsoever. It's too frightful for words.
He gloomed at me, all hang-dog German jowls.
Can you imagine the scandal if it should come out, if it were to reach the Queen's ears, that such a thing had happened in my presence?
He took a step towards me.
My dear Harry, you know about these things. What is to be done?
One thing was plain. It wasn't Cumming's supposed sleight of hand, which I still couldn't credit, that was putting him in a ferment, but that it had happened in a game presided over by his royal grossness. And whatever would Mama say when she heard that he'd been spreading the boards like Faro Jack? Tame stuff from where I stood, compared to his whoremongering and general depravity. But if it had shaken him to the point where I was his dear Harry, he must be desperate. I'd steered him out of more than one scrape in the past, and here he was again, looking at me like an owl in labour. So, first things first.
What does Gordon Cumming say?
He denies it outright, of course. Williams and Coventry saw him before dinner, and
you haven't spoken to him yourself, then?
He shuddered.
No, and I dread it. You think I should not? Oh, if I could avoid it. How am I to face him, an old friend, an intimate of years, a fellow officer, a baronet, damn it, a man of honour?
Aye, that's a word we'll hear more of before this is done, thinks I.
Tell me, sir, these eagle-eyed youngsters, how much do they claim Cumming built them of?
He goggled at me.
What on earth has that to do with it? If a fellow cheats, what does the amount matter?
Something, I'd say. Now, I didn't play either night, but my Elspeth said something about 5 and 10 bob stakes, so it can't have been much of a high game.
Well, heavens no, friendly game to amuse the ladies. Why, I set the bank limit at £100 both nights.
So Cumming can't have won more than 100 or 200, can he? Well, I don't know what he's worth. Some say 80,000 per annum. But he has a place in Scotland, house in town, half colonelcy in the Guards, moves in the top flight, and I've never heard he was short of the ready of you.
He shook his head, glowering. Well, sir, would he risk his good name, his commission, his place in society? Good Lord, everything he counts worthwhile, for a few wretched quid that wouldn't keep him in cheroots for a year? Why, sir, it don't bear looking at, even.
And it didn't.
I'm ready to believe evil of anyone, usually with good cause, and especially of Sir William Gordon Cumming Bart, whose reputation I'd have been happy to blacken any day. I'll tell you why presently. But this accusation made no sense at all, quite apart from the mechanical difficulties of the thing, the paltry sums involved, and the ghastly risk he'd have been running, all of which I'd pointed out.
There was my knowledge of the man's character, which was that of a top, lofty prig with immense notions of his own dignity, who'd have regarded cheating as shocking bad form, and never mind dishonesty. No, it wouldn't do. But there was no persuading Bertie the Bounder of that. He was in such a funk about the possible scandal that sweet reason was lost on him, and those two duffers, Coventry and Williams, had convinced him that the evidence was overwhelming. How, they demanded, when I'd prevailed on the Prince to have him in so that I might hear their tale first hand, could five intelligent young people be mistaken, not on one occasion only, but on several? "Hold hard a moment," says I. "Let's take an order. Two nights ago, Monday, you played baccarat in the smoking room after dinner. I was only in and out while you played. But as I recall, you had three card tables pushed together with a cloth over them to play at. Your Highness had the bank. Williams was croupier," cries Bertie, eager to share the guilt.
"Only on the second night, sir," says Williams. "There was no croupier on the Monday."
Bertie scowled but couldn't deny it. "At all events, there were two tableaus of players, one to your right, sir, and one to your left. Where was Gordon Cummings sitting?" They consulted about this and decided he'd been in the left-hand group, or tableau. Mrs. Arthur Wilson, our host's wife, had been first to the Prince's left, then an empty chair, though they couldn't swear it had never been occupied, then Barclay Levitt, then, round the corner, young Jack Wilson, the son of the house, and Gordon coming next to him, with one of the summit sets beyond. Each staked individually and took turns at handling the cards dealt to their side.
"How did they place their stakes, precisely?" I asked.
"With counters supplied by His Highness," says Coventry, looking at him as though he were an opium runner. "I think I see the case yonder."
Sure enough, there was a polished wooden box on the table, and Bertie opened it reluctantly, to display the leather counters, all stamped with His Feathers crest, brown 10-pound chips, bright red fivers, blue onces, and so on. Tools of the devil, I could hear the Queen calling them. They travelled with him everywhere. "I take it everyone staked before His Highness dealt," says I, pushing their counter, or counters, forward on the table. "Then the cards would be dealt. Your Highness would declare the bank's score, and then you'd pay out or rake in accordingly. Is that so, sir?" Bertie gave a furtive grunt. He was hating this as much as I was enjoying it, I dare say. "Well, then what happened?" They all stood mum, waiting on each other. "Come along, gentlemen," says I, getting brisk. "Who saw whom cheating, and when, and how?" It was like pulling teeth. They hemmed and hawed, or at least Coventry did, while Williams contradicted him, and Bertie ground his teeth and flung his cigar in the fire. At last they got it straight, more or less. On the very first deal, young Jack Wilson had seen Cummings stake £5, and then, looking again when their side won and the Prince was preparing to pay out, had seen to his astonishment that Cummings' stake had magically increased from one red counter to three. £15, where there'd only been £5 before. He couldn't be mistaken, because Cumming placed his stake on a piece of white paper which he used for making notes of the play. Young Wilson had thought it damned odd, and later, on the fifth or sixth deal, he couldn't swear which, when their side had won again, he'd seen Cumming drop three red chips, furtive-like, onto the paper where there'd originally been only one. He'd collected £20, cool as damn it, and young Wilson had whispered to Levitt, seated beside him, the good news, that his colonel was working a flanker. Levitt had sworn Wilson must be wrong, but had watched himself, and blowed if he hadn't seen Cumming do the same thing again, twice. Once he'd added 2 £5 chips, and the second time he'd added one, on both occasions after his tableau had been declared the winner. Described like that in detail, it sounded impressive, I had to admit, and the Prince regarded me with piggy triumph. "There, you see, Flashman, two men, one in his own regiment, too, and both sure of what they saw."
"You saw nothing out of the way yourself, sir?"
"Certainly not. I was occupied with the cards and the bank." True enough, he would be. But there was something damn strange which they'd evidently overlooked. "If Cummin was cheating," I asked them, "why on earth did he use the brightest chips, the red fivers?" I indicated the open box. "Look at them, they stand out a mile. and to make him even more conspicuous, he laid them on a white paper. Hang it also, if he wanted to be caught, he couldn't have been more obvious. They couldn't explain it, and Bertie said testily that what I'd said might very well be true, but it didn't alter the fact that he'd been seen padding his stakes, whatever blasted colour they were, and what was to be done, eh? I said I'd heard the stories of young Wilson and Levitt, but what about the other three? William said that after the first night's play, young Wilson had told his mother what he and Levitt had seen. Wilson's sister and her husband, a chap called Lysett Green, had also been informed, and they'd resolved to keep an eye on Cumming the next night, Tuesday. Young Wilson had arranged for a long table to be set up in the billiard room, covered with baize, and with a chalk line round the margin beyond which the stakes would be placed. That way, they thought Cumming wouldn't be able to cheat. I couldn't believe my ears. "Were they mad?" says I. "They were sure the man was a swindler, yet they were prepared to play with him again and spy on him. And they never thought to tell old Wilson, the father of the family, or anyone senior." Coventry looked stuffed at this, and Bertie muttered about the shocking state of society nowadays. Ignorant upstarts who knew no better. And he was a fool to have come within 100 miles of the compounded place, etc., etc. William said that Mrs. Wilson had wanted at all costs to avoid a scandal, and if they hadn't played it would have looked odd, and people might have talked, and so on and so forth. "Very well. What happened on the Tuesday night?" I asked. "Was he seen juggling his chips again?"
"Twice at least," says Williams. "He was seen to push a 10-pound counter over the line after His Highness had declared baccarat to the bank,"
meaning the bank had lost.
"On another occasion, he used his pencil to flick a 5-pound counter, increasing his 2-pound stake to 7 pounds, which," he added gloomily, "was what I, as croupier, paid him."
"But you saw nothing irregular yourself?"
"No, though I recall that at one hand, I can't tell which, Cumming called out to His Highness, 'There is another tenner due here, sir,' and from what I've learned this evening, I believe it may have been an occasion when he played wrongly."
"He was one of your decent asses, Williams, and didn't like to say it plain. I remember distinctly telling him to put his stakes where I could see 'em," says Bertie, "but I suspected nothing." "Who was sitting by him the second night?"
Coventry gave a start. "Why, my wife, Lady Coventry, but I believe she gave her place up to Lady Flashman for one or two coups, did she not, Williams?"
"Why, so she did," says Williams, turning to me. "I remember now, Cumming was advising your wife about her stakes, Flashman." He gave a ruptured grin. "They were being rather jolly about it, you know. She was, well, I gathered she did not know much about the game, and he was helping her." "I don't suppose she saw anything fishy," says Bertie bitterly. I knew what he meant. If Cumming had worn a black mask and made 'em turn out their pockets at pistol point, she'd have thought it was all in the game. "Well, there you are, Flashman," says Bertie. He flung down in a chair, a picture of disgruntled anxiety. "You know as much as we do. It's past belief that Gordon Cumming, of all men..." He gave a despairing shrug. "But there can be no doubt of it, can there?" He was positively yearning at Coventry and Williams. "They are certain of what they saw?" "Sure as a gun," they told him, so I intruded the kind of question that occurs only to minds like mine. "And you're satisfied they ain't lying?" says I, and was met by exclamations of dismay. Pause in the air. "Whatever next?"
"Of course they're not," barks Bertie. "Heavens above, man, would they invent such a dreadful thing?"
"It's about as likely as Bill coming cheating for a few sovs," I reminded him. "But there it is, one or t'other, unless Levitt and young Wilson were drunk in seeing double."
"Well, you Flashman," cries Williams, "and the other witnesses on the second night? You'll hardly suggest that Mrs. Wilson or Mrs. Lysett Green were..."
"No, General, but I will suggest that people often see what they expect to see. And I'm damn sure both those ladies and Lysett Green sat down last night convinced, from what they've been told, that Cumming was a wrong one. Very well," I went on, as they whinnied their protests and Bertie told me I was talking bosh. "Have it as you please. I still say Cumming hasn't been nailed to the wall hard enough to satisfy me. But he's got a heap of explaining to do, I grant you." I set my sights on Bertie. "And since your Highness has done me the honour to ask my advice, I respectfully suggest that you examine these 5 all-seeing accusers yourself, and Gordon Cumming, before things go any further." Since this was plain common sense, it earned me a couple of bovine looks and a royal glare and growl, so I begged leave to withdraw and loafed off, leaving the three wise men to blink at each other and resume their chorus of "What is to be done?" Five words which are as sound a motto for disaster as I know. I've heard them at Kabul before the retreat, at Cawnpore, on the heights above the North Valley at Balaclava, and I won't swear someone wasn't croaking them as we laboured up the greasy grass slope behind G.A. Custer. God rest his fat-headed soul. No one ever knows the answer, you see, so everyone looks blank until the man in command, in this case, good Prince Edward, makes up his mind in panic and invariably does the wrong thing. I took a turn in the empty billiard room, imbibing a meditative brandy and tickling the pills while I considered this unexpected but most welcome bit of mischief, which promised to enliven what had been a damn dull visit so far. I've never been any hand, as you know, at dancing attendance on royalty, unless it's young and female, but especially not beastly Bert, nor do I enjoy the unsought hospitality of society parvenus in the wilds of Yorkshire. A sort of English Texas, peopled by coarse braggarts and one or two decentish slow bowlers, with nothing to do but watch horses run in the pouring rain. Racing's well enough when you're young and riding yourself, but now that I was in my 70th year and disinclined to back anything more mettlesome than an armchair, that is to say a docile horse, I found it quite as interesting as a sermon in Gaelic. So, this baccarat nonsense with its splendid possibilities of scandal, disgrace, and general devilment looked made to order for diversion, provided it was properly mismanaged, which, with Bertie in a fine funk, Coventry and Williams advising, and myself ready to butter the stairs as chance offered, it probably would be. You may think this a tame enough occupation for one who has assisted at as many major catastrophes as I have, and a poor setting after the camps and courts of the mighty. But I was getting on, you know. As the good book says, there's a time for racketing about crying ha-ha among the trumpets, and a time for sitting back with your feet dipped in butter watching others fall in the mire. And I may tell you, not all adventures are to be found midst shot and shell, thank God. What happened at Trambycroft that September week of 90 was as desperate a drama, in its quiet way, as any I've struck, and a mystery which has baffled the wise for 20 years. But will no longer, for I was in the thick of it, and can tell you precisely what happened and why, and since I'll be snug in my long home ere this account meets the public eye, supposing it ever does, you may rely on its truth, incredible as it may appear. In the first place, I'd never have gone near Trambycroft but for Elspeth. She was a bosom chum of young Daisy Brooke, who was half her age and one of the leading society fillies of the day, but cast in the same eccentric mould. Well, you know what Elspeth's like. And Daisy, who was known as Babbling Brooke, was a sort of mad socialist. Even today, when she's Countess of Warwick, no less, she still raves in a ladylike way about the workers. Enough said. At the time of Tranby, she was a stunning looker, rich as Croesus, randy as a rabbit, and Prince Bertie's mount of the moment. Indeed, I ain't sure she wasn't the love of his life, for he'd thrown over Lily Langtree in her favour, and remained uncommon faithful to her until Keppel started wobbling her rump at him. I'll say this for him, he had fine taste in bareback riders, as I should know. I'd shared Langtree with him behind his back, and done my duty by pretty Daisy, as who hadn't? Not La Keppel, though she was after my time, worse luck, not heaving in view until I'd reached what Macaulay calls the years of chicken broth and flannel, when you realise how damn ridiculous you'd look chasing Dolly Mops young enough to be your daughter, and seek solace in booze, baccy, and books. Regrettable, of course, but less tiring and expensive. Anyway, young Daisy Brooke had been first of the invited guests to Tranby, and had persuaded Bertie that the party would be incomplete without her pal Elspeth, Lady Flashman. I had my own jaundiced view of that, born of 50 years' marriage to my dear one, who, I had reason to believe, have not been averse to male attentions in those years when I've been abroad funking the Queen's enemies. Not that I could be certain, mind you, never have been, and she may have been as chaste as Saint Cecilia, but I strongly suspected that the little trollop had been galloped by half the army list, including H.R.H., the Prince of Wales, and William Gordon Cumming, part. True, it was only gossip that she and Bertie had been at grips in a potting shed at Windsor in 59, when I was off in Maryland helping to start the Yankee Civil War. But I'd seen him ogling her on and off ever since. As to the last coming, he was too tall and fair and Greek godlike by half, and had made a dead run at Elspeth back in the 60s. And him 20 years her junior, the lecherous young rip. No doubt he'd been successful, but I'd no proof. She'd basked in his admiration right enough, but since she did that with every man she met, it meant neither nought nor somewhat. The thing that set coming apart from her other flirtations was that after 20 years' acquaintance she'd suddenly dropped him like a hot rivet, even cut him dead in the row. I never knew why and didn't inquire. The less I knew of her transgressions, and she of mine, the better. I reckon that's why we've always been such a loving couple. I'd run across Cumming professionally in Zululand, where he was staff-walloping Chelmsford while I was fleeing headlong from Isandlwana. And we'd met here and there at home, and been half-civil, as I always am to suspected old flames of Elspeth. Wouldn't have anyone to talk to otherwise, and you can't have them thinking you're a jealous husband. By the time of Tranby, to be sure, Elspeth was of an age where it should have been unlikely that either Bertie or Cumming would try to drag her behind the sofa. But I still didn't care to think of her within the fat-fingered reach of one, or the trim moustache of t'other. She'd worn uncommon well, middle 60s, and still shaped like a Turkish belly dancer, with the same guileless idiot smile and wondrous blue eyes that had set me slavering when she was 16. She'd performed like a demented houri then, and who was to say she'd lost the taste in half a century? Why, I remember reading of some French king's mistress, Pompadour or some such, who was still grinding away when she was 18. Well, there you are. So, I wasn't best pleased when the Tramby invitation arrived. However, I figured that with Daisy on hand to keep Bertie busy, and Cumming reportedly pushing about some American female, I could stop at home with an easy mind. Then at the last minute, blessed if one of Daisy's aged relatives didn't croak, and since it would not have done for dear Lady Flashman to attend their foul house party unaccompanied, I was dragooned, cursing, into the service. I doubt if our prince gave 3 cheers either. For all the good toadian turns I'd done him, he was still leery of me, and didn't care to look me in the eye. Guilty conscience, no doubt. Until now, that is, when he found himself taken unawares by the makings of a prime scandal, and the prospect of being ritually disemboweled by our gracious sovereign when she heard of it, and served the fat blighter right. I reflected on these matters as I shoved the ivories round the cushions and reviewed events since we'd assembled at Tramby 2 days earlier, which was Monday. It was your middling country house, owned by a shipping money-bags named Wilson. Not society, as you'd notice. But his place was convenient to Doncaster, where they were running the ledger on the Wednesday, and if his family and friends were second-run, as these things are judged in the impolite world, well, Prince Bertie was a fellow vulgarian, and right at home. There were enough of his regular crawlers, Cumming and the Somersets, to keep him happy. The Wilson gang toadied him to admiration, and as in most bourgeois establishments, the rations, liquor, and appointments were first-rate. None of your freezing baronial banquet halls where the soup arrived stone-cold after being toted half a mile by gouty servitors, and the bedsprings haven't been seen to since Richard III's day. It was cosy, and quite jolly. The young folk were lively, without being a nuisance. Bertie was at ease and affable, and if it was all a dead bore, it was comfortable at least. Elspeth was in her element, flaunting her mature charms on the first evening in a Paris rig-out, which drew glittering smiles of envy from the female brigade, and an approving grunt and leer from Bertie.
She'd had the deuce of a struggle getting into the thing, with me heaving at her stays. But once all was fast and sheeted home, she looked nothing like the grandmother she was, with her hair artfully tinted, and that milky complexion carefully enhanced, but above all with that happy, complacent radiance which she hasn't lost yet. And she's close on 90 now. Aye, she's always had the priceless gift of pleasing, as Elspeth, and making people laugh, for she's a damn funny woman when she wants to be, a top-hole mimic, and all the more engaging because she plainly hasn't got two brains to rub together. Never see her, but it sets me in humour, Palmerston used to say. That was her talent, to make folk happy.
She charmed Bertie, seated by her at dinner, one admiring glances from the other men with her artless prattle, and to my astonishment even exchanged pleasant banter with Gordon Cumming. "Hello," thinks I, as the old fire rekindled. Watching her at work, I rather liked the look of her myself. And that night, waking in the small hours to find that plump excellence cuddled up against me, I was amazed to find myself inspired to climb aboard, puffing and creaking, while she giggled drowsily, saying I was a disgrace and would do myself a mischief.
"At our age," she murmured afterwards, "whatever would the children say? Oh, Harry, lad, do you mind the Madagascar forest? Harry? Harry? My dear, are you all right? Shall I fetch you a glass of water? A little brandy, perhaps?"
I was thinking, glory, glory, what a hell of a way to die, being in no condition to move, let alone answer. But I remember noting that she hadn't minded a bit, and saying to myself, "Aye, you'll still bear watching." But fond recollection has carried me ahead of events. It was on that night after dinner that the prince had proposed baccarat, and Cumming had supposedly cheated for the first time. I'd no inkling of this, of course, nor yet on the Tuesday evening when he'd been seen doctoring his stakes yet again, the bounder, they said. Now, on the Wednesday night, the murder was out, among a few people anyway, and I was in the pool room trying to fathom it, and I confess wondering what I might do to jolly the mischief along. Well, you know my style, and between ourselves, wouldn't you? First, though, to the fathoming. So far as I could judge, there was a choice of three explanations, each one so far-fetched as to be nigh impossible. Odds on, with the punters in the know, was that Cumming had cheated. It didn't wash with me, much though I'd have liked to believe it. He was a prime tick, an arrant snob, a very model of military and social excellence, cool, handsome, lordly, rich, and moustached. Wore his handkerchief in his sleeve, looked down his nose at the world, probably was too fastidious to shave in his bath. Might well be a former paramour of my beloved, and on all these counts was ripe for any dirty turn I could serve him. But that wasn't the point. However detestable I might think him, the plain fact was that swindling simply wasn't his style. I told myself that even the unlikeliest folk do the damnedest things. Was it possible that Cumming was the kind of reckless ass who'd play foul in a trifling game, not for gain, but for the sheer mad fun of the thing, to see if he could get away with it? There are such fellows. I've seen them. Rudy Starnberg, for one. But he was a villain, in love with knavery. Cumming wasn't, and for all the bone-headed bravery he'd supposedly shown at Ulundi and in the Sudan, I couldn't see him bucking this tiger. He had too much to lose. And while I hate to say it, he was a gentleman. Then the witnesses were either mistaken or lying, but error must be discounted. Two or even three people might improbably be mistaken, but five on two different nights. So all that remained was a conspiracy to disgrace Gordon Cumming by five assorted perjurers. Ridiculous, you say? Well, I don't. I've sworn truth out of England myself all too often, and seen the saintliest specimens lie themselves black and blue for the unlikeliest reasons. I've also known from the age of three that honour and solemn oath and word of a gentleman are mere piss in the wind of greed, ambition, and fear. Still, you had only to look at the five witnesses to see that conspiracy was too far-fetched altogether,
None of them even knew Cumming all that well, or had reason to dislike him, let alone plot his ruin, and one of them could be ruled out flat. Here they are. Arthur Stanley, Jack Wilson, son of the house, a bright young spark who lived off Papa and hoped to be taken for a man about town, fairly brainless and possibly capable of being wild, at a thought, but hardly vicious. His sister, Mrs. Lycett Green, middling pretty, inoffensive, ordinary enough, and decidedly not Lucrezia Borgia in the making. Her husband, Lycett Green, a stiffish, old young man, well pleased with himself and his position as master of foxhounds in some northern swamp. In my experience, there are dolts, pompous dolts, and MFHs, master of foxhounds, but they aren't the plotting kind. Barclay Levitt, a sound muttonhead in Cumming's regiment, and presumably as well disposed to his chief as subalterns ever are, given that guards' officers are usually incapable of any feeling outside their bellies and loins. Four unlikely conspirators, you'll allow, unless you conceived it possible that Cumming, a noted rake, had ravished Mrs. Lycett Green before tea on the Monday and provoked the other three into concocting a diabolical plot to avenge her honour. But the fifth witness killed the plot notion stone dead. She was Mrs. Arthur Wilson, our host's wife, as respectable a matron as ever rebuked a cook. Nervously gratified beyond measure at the honour of having royalty to stay, and the last person, as Bertie himself had remarked, to wish to have scandal breaking over her roof. If she said she'd seen Cumming jockeying his chips, she meant it. So there was no explanation, and if I wanted to get to the bottom of the mystery, which I confess was beginning to intrigue me for its own sake, I needed more eyewitness information. It would also be as well to discover if the scandal had leaked at all.
This book is continued on Disc 9.